This is Ann Lammers, Jung and Victor White, May 14th, 2004.
Suggested reading, recommended further reading. I really should have listed Von Franz, Marie-Louise Von Franz, and James Hillman, their books that they did together called Jung's Typology, because if you haven't read it, there's a great deal to be gotten out of it, and I'll be referring to the inferior function, which is what von Franz's essay is all about in that book. So that's Marie-Louise von Franz and James Hillman, Jung's Typology, Dallas, Texas, Spring Publications, 1984, originally 1971. Thank you all for being here. If I don't generally speak real loud, and so John's going to, it's John, right? John's going to keep track of the volume, but if you can't hear, let him know. Let me know too. I understand from speaking with members of this society before the lecture that the content of lectures here, presentations here, varies. Sometimes it's extremely practical, personal, experiential, and sometimes it's more like what I'm going to be doing, which is on the scholarly, theoretical, historical side. But I would like those of you who are accustomed to an experiential and personal presentation to keep your ears tuned. I'm sorry about the... It's like sitting behind a column. Keep your ears tuned. You will hear in my voice and sometimes in my actual words that this material is an experience I've been having for 20 years now, and that I'm talking about the two men, Jung, C.G. Jung and Victor White, as if, almost as if I knew them, almost as if I had been counseling with them as a troubled couple. their friendship was a very deep and very important friendship for both of them, and it could be that what they had at stake in their friendship is also important to us. By engaging in their friendship, Victor White and C.G. Jung undertook what I believe was really a sacred process of growth and learning and healing, trusting each other's human capacities as well as the wind of the spirit, which entered into one of White's early dreams about their relationship. They could not know when they first got to know each other, and they did first get to know each other in 1945, as soon as World War II was over and letters and packages could go from England to Switzerland. White immediately wrote to Jung. They couldn't know when they first got to know each other how much discrepancy there was between their two thought worlds. And in a way, they got trapped by their own enthusiasm and their own deep dedication to their collaboration and to the work they were trying to do together. They got trapped in the consequences of misunderstandings, which only surfaced, only became really clear as time went on. There were some key concepts that were only partly translatable. They used the metaphor of the bridge. They were always talking about there needs to be a bridge between these two worlds. Well, they thought they could build one. And the concepts that couldn't quite be translated or brought across the bridge, like a firm, you know, a good trustworthy bridge is supposed to transport you from one side to the other safely. God versus the God image. They didn't always know right at the beginning. Or Victor White tried to pin Jung down and didn't quite understand Jung's careful caveats when he talked about the God image. Christ and the self. Sin and shadow. soul and psyche, health and salvation. It turned out that they had competing or differing epistemologies, and I'll say more about that later on. But if you know what that 50-cent word is all about, it's really talking about how do you know anything? How do you know what you mean when you say the soul? Well, how do you know what you mean when you say God? And Jung would say at the end of his life, I don't need to believe, I know. Well, how did he know? Through dreams, through the work he'd done with his patients, through his active imagination, through his reading, and also, of course, through Christian revelation and Judeo-Christian literature as he interpreted it. But it wasn't how Victor White knew. Victor White knew because he worked through the world of revelation as it was understood in the Catholic Church through centuries of teaching about what was Orthodox thought. And he understood and he knew because of the use of philosophy and categories of reason, which Jung was really allergic to. So in the end, they had a difference in their deep syntax. It sounded like they were saying the same things, and then gradually it turned out that they really couldn't say the same things about what mattered the most to them. And at the end of his life, White admitted finally in public, perhaps I really don't understand what it meant by the self. So perhaps their story provides some signposts and some warnings that may be of meaning as we think about our own attempts to belong to partnerships, collaborations, friendships, belong to communities that touch on religious or ultimate concerns, the mysteries of good and evil and numinous experience and human wholeness and what it means to believe. I'd like to show you Victor White's handwriting and the personal way that he wrote to C.G. Jung in 1945. I'd like you to be able to get to know this man a tiny bit. We all know a good deal about Jung. Let's see, is that better? I should duck down. Can people see past this? Is that better? Dear Professor Jung, although I have never had the honor to meet you outside of my dreams, I'm taking the very great liberty of sending to you some of my writings concerning your psychology, written from a Catholic point of view. White sent four offprints, four essays that he had written about the synthesis, what he thought could be the synthesis between Orthodox Catholic thinking, teaching, religious teaching, and Jung's psychology. There were things about Jung's psychology that he had decided made it the perfect modern science to combine with Catholic theology so that there would be a new synthesis, like what Thomas Aquinas did in the 13th century, which would make, well, you know, it was good in the 13th century. What Aquinas did was great. But it doesn't exactly speak to modern people. And White was interested in having Catholic thought become digestible and usable and accessible to modern people who had done a little scientific thinking, perhaps. And Jung's psychology made sense, and it chimed together with White's theology, or so he was convinced, by doing about some months of analytic work with John Layard in England in 1940, and by reading everything he could get his hands on of Jung's, and by going to a study group that included John Layard, Gerhard Adler, and I forget who all the other people were in England at that time during the Second World War. There were some bright lights who had fled from Germany or people who had been in England anyway and who had been turned on to Jung's thought. And they were getting together in London every so often and having fantastic theoretical and personal conversations about Jung's thought. They included some other clergy, and White was very excited by what he was learning. So he sent Jung all of his writings. And Victor White may not have been a genius, I think C.G. was, but Victor was no slouch. He was a good theologian. He was a bright man. And he cared deeply about what he was writing about, and he was trying really hard to connect to Jung in the way that Jung had always wished a theologian would connect to his thought. So Jung wrote back with great enthusiasm, and they were launched with great speed. That's page one of Victor White's first letter to Jung. And just so that you can see something of the casualness of this, I mean, this is just handwritten on two sides of a half sheet of Blackfriars Oxford stationery. I might mention that there's a great and growing interest in this country among Catholics, as well as many others, in the theory and practice of analytical psychology, and that I personally am one of very many who owe to you and your disciples in England an immense debt of gratitude. May I be permitted to convey my belated congratulations on your recent birthday and express my thankfulness for your recovery. White was hearing personal news of Jung through Jung's disciples in England. He felt as though he was already part of the family, as it were. Yours very obediently and gratefully, Father Victor White, O.P. P.S. I can read it better here. I've also just finished a short article concerning the criticisms of your attitude to religion in J.C. Flugel's Man, Morals, and Society, which I will also take the liberty of sending to you. That was number four of the four. While we're focused up there, I'm sorry. Go ahead, turn it off again. I'll show you one more picture. See the man himself. That may have been the first visit to Bowling Green. They're standing outside the tower. That's the wood pile over there on the left. And White was in his clericals because he was probably, I think I'm in people's way, he was probably on his way to visit Einsiedeln and the Benedictine convent, the monastery that's there. Anyway, he wouldn't have worn his clericals most of the time at Bowlingen. This was a special occasion. The first time that Jung invited him to Bowlingen, he warned him to bring some disreputable clothing and his most casual shoes so they could go sailing. I think it's interesting to look at the expressions on the faces. Jung looks rather concerned, to my mind. And White looks as though he's the cat who swallowed the canary. And I think there may be a connection. Victor White was 26 years younger than Jung. He was born in 1902. And that if that was 1946, he was 44, right? Yeah. That's my guess. That might have been the first visit, which happened in 46. I've mentioned I've given you a list of books that I think might be useful if you want to do more reading on any aspects of this lecture. But I want to mention another book that you can't get yet because it's not published yet. This is my copy of As Good As It's Gotten So Far, the letters of Victor White and C.G. Jung, which I've been preparing for publication for five, 6 years now. It's getting very close. I think it might leave my desk this summer and go to Routledge. We're almost to the point of having an editorial contract, finally. It's very exciting for me. It's very rich stuff for me. I've never gotten tired of it. So this is a forthcoming book, and a lot of what I have to say comes from being very, very close to these texts. And I'll read you some of what's in there, and I'll paraphrase some because I've just about got it inside me now. But I want to mention also the support for getting this thing published. Just a word on behalf of those who try to put stuff out into the market, into the world, that has been hidden away in the archive in Switzerland. It takes a lot to get it there. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of research. It takes hours and hours and hours of searching for obscure references so you can footnote them, because these two men knew everything and everybody, and they'd read everything, and it's all there in the letters. They threw it at each other. They were very enthusiastic in the first years. And it was sort of like, I want you to get to know my world. I'm going to let you know every exciting thing that's crossed my path. And so it's all there in the letters, and I find myself researching stuff that's from the Middle Ages and from obscure museums in Oxford and you know, BBC lectures that were done by various people in the 1940s, and it's mind-splitting. It takes money to publish these things, because people like me still, even though we live very much in our heads, we have to eat, and so the money for the project comes from various foundations, and the most recent foundation to dawn on the world of Jungian scholarship is this one, which you've got a handout about, and you're receiving news about it about as early as anybody, and it's really a very big deal. The Philemon Foundation just got started last July, and this book that will come out eventually will be one of the first volumes in the Philemon series. They're going to take over where the Bollingen series left off. And instead of intending to publish the collected works of C.G. Jung, they're intending to publish the complete works of C.G. Jung. There's tens of thousands of documents to be published. A tremendous amount of material that hasn't gotten out yet. It may take 30 years or more just to do the first piece of the task that they intend to do. And it's looking as though it's going to be a successful foundation with a big endowment, so it will last. And the next generation of scholars can be trained out of that. So I owe them the last significant grant, which is going to see this on its way, and probably I'll continue to do more publishing because they exist. I'll continue to do more editing of that Jungian material, and so will a bunch of other people around the world that are, you know, just by divine calling required to do this work. It isn't always them. It isn't always fun or easy, but it's, I just seem to have to do it. Let me tell you about the arc of the story. This story has a shape. There is an up movement followed by a down movement, and then a morass, nothing, an abyss, and then at the very end of Victor White's life, 2 years of reconciliation and rescuing what had been a very important friendship, but it had gone into the trash. The people involved, just in the letters now, the people involved that you see in the letters, Jung and his household, that is, his wife wrote one of the letters to Victor White. His secretary wrote 19, at various times different secretaries. And Tony Wolfe wrote one letter to Victor White, which is going to be in the collection. At the other end, you've got White and his community of Dominicans in England. They were living in Oxford in one of the major houses of the English Dominicans. Major, not because it's huge, but because That's the place where all the training goes on for the next generation of Dominicans. Victor White was teaching theology to future priests. I don't know how many people here know anything about the politics of the Catholic Church. If you're a Catholic teaching in an institution, even now, today, right now, with the present Pope, and your institution is a secular university, you can teach pretty much what you want, what you think is true and valuable. If you're teaching future priests, if you're working for an institution that gets its stamp of approval from the Vatican, you have to watch it and not say things that the Vatican disapproves, because you may find yourself out of a job and your books may be no longer publishable and you may be silenced. It's not happening in quite the dramatic way now that it did in the 1950s, but you need to know this background, because Victor White got caught up in the jaws of that kind of politics in his own church. However, when the story starts, he is still very happily teaching dogmatic theology in Oxford Blackfriars, and he has a bunch of colleagues around him who, some of them, a few of them, are kindred souls, one in particular, Richard Kehoe, who taught Old Testament. Then there are these dozens and dozens of third parties that I mentioned. They tell each other all about the exciting people in their lives, who give depth to each one's world. And then there are three women who are prominent in the dialogue, not because they are writing letters that are going to be published with these letters, although, well, in two cases, their letters are referred to. But they are important presences, if I can use that word. Toni Sussmann, a German-born Jungian analyst living in Oxford, who had studied with Jung in the 19-teens. She was teaching Jungian analysts in England. She was training them. She had come over. She had escaped from Germany, from Berlin. She had converted to Catholicism, but she was Jewish, and, you know, she had to get out. So here she was living in Oxford, and Victor White had done some training with her. He had taken her seminar or belonged to her class. And he was sending people to her for training. And then he began to hear some odd stuff, and it worried him. And he was worried enough about Toni Sussmann so that she's in his dreams even before he's writing to C.G., and he begins telling C.G. Jung very early about a dream he had where Victor White was one of a small group of people who were given special little medallions by Jung in Jung's garden. These were handed out like wafers from a box with the host, the sacred host, handed out these little medallions. And Victor White said that he realized in his dream he knew who all the people were who were getting these medallions, which meant that they were people who had understood Jung's thought correctly. And Toni Sussmann was not one of them. And he was going to have to tell her. He's dealing with quite a conflict there, because as he refers people to Toni Sussmann and then begins to realize that she might be shading the truth a little and claiming more authority than she really ought to, he gets worried about whether she's going to do damage. So she appears as the problem who is discussed in the first years of their correspondence. The second woman who appears is a woman named Barbara Robb, who is a different kettle of fish altogether. She is a youngish, wife of an artist. She's a former ballet dancer. She's a Catholic lay person and someone that White visits and is good friends with. And she's having a spiritual love affair with Jung, to the point where she's begun to have the same ailments that he has. is synchronicities are going on there. She's having fantasies, dreams, reflections. She's having dreams and long sustained imaginal reflections that she writes down at great length about Jung and about her visions of Jung. And White, in 1946, begins to mention her in his letters, and then very soon sends along, with her permission, of course, chunks of the stuff that she's been producing. White has typed it out, actually. Some of it's with White's typewriter. He transcribed it so that he could send it on to Jung. And Jung is fascinated. He thinks it's really fun. It's interesting. And besides, she's got him right. The things she says about him in her fantasies and her visions, well, it sounds like him. That's the way he really thinks of himself. She's praying for him around the clock that he might be everything he can be, that he might be all he can be. Well, that's exactly how Jung thinks. And he writes back to White about it. He says, I hope that she's not over-identified with the greater self by which she knows me so well. He's a little worried about her becoming inflated. But later on, of course, it's revealed that there's good reason to worry. But she's the reason, I think, that Victor White and Jung warmed up to each other so quickly. They hadn't really begun to warm up. They were still using their formal titles, Dear Professor Jung, Dear Father White. As soon as White sent off her stuff and Jung read it, the next thing that happened in the next letter that Jung wrote is that he addressed White, Dear Father White, W-I-G-H-T, cross out, W-H-I-T-E. Excuse me, he says, in my feebleness, my mind plays tricks on me. And Victor White wrote back and said, why don't you forget both White and White and just call me Victor? And from then on, it was Dear Victor, my dear CG, my dear Victor. They were on first term basis. And I think the timing of it is related to this warm presence of Barbara Robb. These two men were relating to each other through the anima. She was the bridge. And she was not the most positive anima, that will turn up later, but she was a friendly one. She was a loving soul. The third woman who comes into the picture comes in at the very end. And this is the Mother Prioress. There are a few letters published already by C.G. Jung to the Mother Prioress of a contemplative order. If you've looked at the collected letters, you might have spotted a few letters to this Mother Prioress. Her name isn't given. She was Sister Michael of the Blessed Trinity, and she lived in a little town on the Welsh border where she and a small house of Carmelite nuns were cloistered. It wasn't a silent order, but a strictly cloistered order, the Reformed, the Discalced Carmelite. She was an old friend of Victor White. And she was the one, at the end of White's life, after he'd had a nearly fatal motorcycle accident, they didn't know he had cancer yet, she's the one who wrote to C.G. Jung. And the two men had been on the outs. They hadn't been talking. They hadn't been writing. They hadn't seen each other in a few years. But Victor was seriously injured. And Sister Michael wrote to Jung, not mentioning White's serious accident. She wrote to Jung to congratulate him on his birthday, to tell him how much she and her sisters prayed for him every day, to tell him that Victor White had given them a huge amount of Jung's thought and feeling and wisdom. that they had built their little cluster of buildings in their this is a place they had recently moved to. They had had assistance in building it, and at least one of those little cottages had been built on the same model as what Niklaus von Flüe lived in Einsiedeln in Switzerland. And Brother Klaus was one of Jung's patron saints, one of the people he loved dearly in Swiss history. This little group of nuns were deeply indebted to Jung. And by the way, Jung couldn't miss, they were deeply indebted to Jung because of Victor White. And the sincerity of her loving approach, I think that was the letter. I have read her letters. They won't be published for at least 20 more years, but I think that was the letter in which she actually said to him that he would, sooner than she would, he would be entering the gate of heaven and be greeted there as a little boy, a beloved little boy. All the cares of his years would fall from him, and he would be embraced in heaven. And she simply knows this. She shares with him that this, you know, I think it takes a cloistered nun to write that to a great man. And of course, and thank goodness, Jung's heart was warmed and moved. And he conveyed greetings to his old friend through her. And the next thing you know, White has written to him, and their correspondence resumes for some months before White's death. That's quite a lot of information already about the story. But I want to say something about these two men and what brought them together. Jung was halfway a theologian. Despite promising his father never to go near theology, his father made him promise, don't be a theologian, whatever you do. He promised. But you know, he couldn't help it. He had hung out in his father's library when he was 12. When he was too sick to go to school, he kept fainting, and he had to stay home, and he was just hanging out in the library reading his father's theological books. He'd been overhearing conversations. He'd been soaking up sermons. He'd been reading the Bible since he was a kid. He knew the Protestant, or at least the Swiss Reformed theology. He knew it very well from the inside. Didn't always like it, but he knew it. Where he needed help was on the Catholic side, and he said so. Jung's project at the end of his life, and Murray Stein writes about this in Jung's treatment of Christianity. Jung's project was to try to heal the dangerous splits in consciousness between Catholic and Protestant, for example, in the European world. And he said also in himself, he said that even though he'd been raised as a Protestant, he experienced the split, the schism between Catholic and Protestant as if it was his own. He needed instruction on the Catholic side because he wanted to explore the psychological importance of the ancient sacraments and rituals and their connections to the personal psyche, yes, but also to Gnosticism and alchemy, which had become passionate interests of his. Now, on his side, as a priest, White was a trained spiritual guide and confessor. He was briefly in Jungian analysis with John Layard in London. Odd thing about John Layard. John Layard was an odd person anyway, in a lot of ways. John Layard took White on as his patient, as an alisand, when White was in a terrible conflict about whether to stay in his order or not. And between you and me, I think that he had someone that he was really kind of in love with, and he just wasn't sure what to do. in 1940. John Layard was fine, I think, for him as an analyst until White got the word from Gerhard Adler that it might be a good idea if he sent his stuff off to C.G. Jung in Switzerland, and did so and became Jung's new friend. And Layard didn't take it very well. Layard's wife, Doris, remained good friends with Victor White to his death. She was visiting him on his deathbed, but John Layard was estranged. So it was a brief analysis. And White himself tried to become an analyst, and he sometimes refers to people that he's seeing for spiritual counseling and whatever else was involved as his analysands. And Jung, in one of his letters, even refers to White's analysands. It was a time in the Jungian movement when people were very casual in these categories. So becoming an analyst was not very well defined. People like White could claim to be in some sort an analyst, although White was careful and knew that he wasn't fully trained. I asked Gerhard Adler, me, once, when Adler was still living, if White was himself an analyst, because I saw these words used in the letters. And Adler, who didn't have a lot of energy left, who was very old, sent back a one-word answer scribbled in the margin next to that question: dilettante. But it was Adler who encouraged White to write to Jung. So in 1945, at least, Adler thought that White had something to contribute, as he undoubtedly did. He just wasn't an analyst. White's project, on his side, I've mentioned this, it was a synthesis between Catholic theological orthodoxy and the best of modern science. He chose Jung's psychology mainly because its teleology seemed miraculously consistent with the thought of Aristotle and Aquinas. Also because he, White, was already in thought and practice halfway a Jungian. So you've got White on his side being halfway a practitioner of Jung's psychology, and Jung on his side being halfway a theologian. And they, with those credentials, they thought they understood enough of each other's world. When I said that Jung's psychology is consistent, or that White thought so, and I use the word teleology, I don't know if that, it's another 50-cent word. The element in Jung's thought that was so appealing to White, and that plays a role, I think, even in the story between the two of them, is the prospective work of the unconscious, looking towards wholeness, wanting to create a greater wholeness for the individual, for the society, that the unconscious is constantly trying to become conscious or to incarnate. The self wants to incarnate in a historical form. The archetypes are on the lookout for chances to express themselves. And people's disastrous experiences in life, if they don't kill you, they may be for something. Suffering may be meaningful. It may be aimed at a greater wholeness, a greater development of the personality. And it was that kind of movement towards something in the future, movement towards a goal, towards an end, that qualified as teleology, telos meaning the goal in Greek. That was what the main thing that attracted Jung, White to Jung's thought. They were surrounded, the two of them, by some institutional and collective forces. Jung had an ongoing effort to remain legitimate in the medical community. I think he didn't worry about it as much as he got older. But even so, in one of his early letters to White, he corrects White's use of the word instinct because he warns him he doesn't want White to get it wrong and attribute wrong thoughts to Jung because Jung's medical colleagues will catch that and count it, Jung's reputation will be damaged. If White attributes a kind of thinking to Jung that isn't really scientifically adequate. And so Jung corrects him and White apologizes and never says that again. Another aspect of Jung's collective world was his long-standing bitterness about Protestantism, echoes of his father's sad career, and his disdain on the other side for what he called medieval thought, which is what he attributed to most of the Catholic theologians that he knew. At the same time that he looked down on medieval thinking, people whose thinking was stuck in an altogether spiritual realm, or what he called Trinitarian thought, couldn't bring the fourth in, couldn't bring in the solid matter of the earth and the feminine and the shadow. At the same time, I think he envied the certainty of those who were authentically rooted in faith. And he urgently needed to know about what belonged to White's tradition. On White's side, I've mentioned that there's a terribly pervasive politics in Roman Catholic theological world, and White got caught in it. In 1950, there was an official document published within the Catholic Church called Humani Generis. It was a papal bull that was an official reaction against modernism. And on the strength of that document, a lot of Catholic theologians in the 1950s were silenced because they were judged to be too modernist, too scientific, too skeptical, too inclusive of the culture. You should also know, if you don't already, that in the religious culture, or in the culture of being a religious, of being a friar, a monk, a nun in the Catholic Church, there is a hierarchical structure of order, of command and obedience that requires that people, at least before Vatican II, it required that people willingly give up their own conscience to take the instruction from above. The idea that you had your own conscience and should use it was really a new idea from Vatican II, and upset a lot of people's lives within religious orders as they began to think for themselves and realized that they were supposed to. So there were invisible hands from above sometimes controlling people's faiths, and that happened with Victor White. In the years when Victor White was working with Jung and really becoming very closely identified with Jung, he was publishing all sorts of stuff about Jung's work. That was most of his publishing, you know, essays, reviews. There was also this clampdown on modernism, which led finally to something that was sort of a Thomistic loyalty oath. Victor White had the opportunity to become the regent of studies in his school at Blackfriars. It would have been like a combination of being the provost and the academic dean. He would have had pretty complete control over the curriculum for those young men who were coming into the Dominicans from the middle 1950s on. Victor White was studying to get his STM, his Master of Sacred Theology, and he had to get that before he could be made Regent of Studies. And he also had to sign this abhorrent to him loyalty oath, which said that he would teach only according to the accepted teachings of Thomas Aquinas, and he knew what that meant. It was code. There was a conservative, a neo-Thomistic, neo-scholastic strand of theology that was in favor with the Vatican or most of the Roman authorities, And Victor White was too good a historian and too good a linguist, well, with Latin anyway, to be willing to jump on that bandwagon. He had a more individual scholarly approach to this teaching of his. And he had to sign the loyalty oath in order to get promoted to Regent of Studies. A great deal rested on this for him. He was an ambitious man. He struggled in 1953 in his letters to Jung. He struggled to decide whether he could stay in the order at all because this oath was driving him crazy. And he had friends like his woman friend in London, Barbara Robb. I don't want to make that sound like it was an improper friendship. It wasn't. It was. He had many friends who were charming, socially active women, lay women, and it flattered him and gave him joy. Barbara Robb was telling him, just sign it. A little perjury for a good cause. Just sign it. And Jung wrote back and said, I disagree. I don't think that's the way to look at it. A little perjury for a good cause is not a good idea. Your soul is more important than that. But look at it this way. Think of yourself as treating your order. Think of yourself as being their therapist. They need you. They need the teaching you can give them. Stay behind where you are. That is, don't go advancing bravely forward the way you know you could, because you'd leave them behind. Treat them as the inmates in a hospital, and you're responsible for them. And White, you know, bit his fingernails and thought really hard. Think of yourself as treating your order. Think of yourself as being their therapist. The inmates in a hospital, and you're responsible for them. And White, you know, bit his fingernails. The inmates in a hospital, and you're responsible for them. And White, you know, bit his fingernails and thought really hard. It was made, was given his STM, was in May, late May of 1954. And according to someone who was there that I got to know, who happened to be living in California, bless him, it was very, very embarrassing for White and for his friends in the order. And he did have some very good friends, and his students loved him. Someone else, sort of a dark horse, was brought in and given this same degree on the same day. And pretty soon after that, White got a letter from his superior, his provincial, the English provincial, telling him that his services weren't needed at Blackfriars. He wasn't going to be Regent of Studies. This other guy was going to be Regent of Studies. And why didn't he go live in Oakland, where there was a Dominican house, for a while? They had to clear him out. It was a huge, embarrassing episode. But his promotion, which he had been given from Rome, had been canceled. And there's quite a story about how that happened. I'm not sure that we have time this evening to go into it, but it was really the doing of his provincial. And it was due to historical accident, because the master general of the whole order, the guy at the top of the Dominicans living in Rome, happened to be a Spaniard who was killed in a car accident in June of that year. Or was it the previous year? Well, he'd been killed in a car accident. And the interim, the temporary master general, who'd come in without any particular preparation because they just had to get somebody in there, and it was his turn, or it was the turn of the American province to send somebody. He was a neophyte. He was a conservative neophyte. And Hilary Carpenter, the Dominican, the provincial in England, saw his chance, basically, and pulled some strings. No one knows, or I don't, someone does, how he did it exactly, what letters were sent, you know, with secret couriers or something to Rome to persuade the interim Master General that this promotion, this appointment that had already been made of Victor White was really a bad idea. And they needed to get somebody in who could be trusted to stick with the tried and true and not go dancing off in some Jungian direction or modernist direction. Anyway, Victor White couldn't be trusted, and you better not let him be promoted, because you know, goodness knows what it will do to us here in England. But we've got a very conservative character that we can bring in on short notice and put in his place. So it was done, you know, something was done in the background. Victor White never found out, couldn't be sure how it had happened. He couldn't find that out. It was, you know, the hand that had done it was hidden. So White went off to exile, basically, to California, which some people might think would be a desirable kind of exile, but for White it was a humiliation and a terrible loss. And he pulled himself together as well as he could there. But while he was there, it was time for him to write a review of a certain book, Job, Answer to Job, had come out in 1952, and as long as it was in German, it was no trouble. But as soon as it was translated into English, which happened in 54, published in England, it was trouble for White. And White, not knowing how he'd lost his job, what happened to my job? What happened to me? Having just sacrificed his conscience, basically, having signed that loyalty oath that he abhorred so that he could be promoted to the job, then suddenly he didn't have it anymore. He didn't have his classroom anymore. He never taught at Oxford Blackfriars again. All of it was gone. And he had decided he couldn't leave the order. At 50-something, he couldn't start over. He had to be angry. Who was there to be angry at? Well, he exploded in print at Jung. And his review of Answer to Job, which came out in 1955 in March in the Blackfriars Journal, had, I think, 7 passages in it that White later, at the end of his life, saw fit to remove before republishing it. He called Jung no better informed in religion than a kindergartner. He said that Answer to Job has the plausibility and complexity of the typical paranoid system. He said that Jung was the emperor without clothes. He said that Jung was trying to test his faithful Catholic followers to see how far they'd follow him before they would say that he was the emperor without clothes. That he was duping his followers. He was pretending to say a lot of crazy stuff that he couldn't possibly mean. And that published condemnation, that personal attack on Jung, was really the reason why in 1955 there was a break between Jung and White. White went back to Switzerland in May of 1955, having already sent this thing off to be published, having written to Jung. Have I kept it over here to show you? I hope I have. Or did I decide it was not good enough? I'll dig it out. Because I've got, even if it's not very clear, you can see the letter that White wrote. which included an apology for what he had done. He said, "I hope you can forgive me for it. It doesn't show any care for my feelings or for yours. But how could you do it?" Let's see. This doesn't come out very well, I'm sorry. This is the first two pages. He was on board the Queen Mary. There, it's as good as it gets. "My dear CG, my mad career in California is over, at least for a time, and I'm trying to recollect myself on the high seas before confronting the ordeals which await me in Europe. It was good to hear from you and good of you to write. I'm puzzled that the quote from Aquinas puzzled you so. I suspect you sought some profound subtlety in it that just isn't there." I guess this is pages 1 and 3, because the backs of those pages were written on. He talks about Toynbee's review of Answer to Job, Philip Toynbee, and so on. And as he goes on in the letter, he gets around to saying that he has written something that Jung may find hard to forgive. His humor is fairly flippant, considering the situation. He says, though I saw the New Statesman one, "I am very afraid indeed that you will think my review, unforgivable, and yet I dare hope you may find more understanding in the expostulations of this Job than in the approval of Bildad, or should it be Bilmom?" And he goes on about another writer. White brought with him to that meeting with Jung, or what he hoped would be a meeting with Jung, in 1955, a long list of problems with Answer to Job, which he hoped they could talk about in detail when they got together. I mean, a long list. It was written on very large, extra large sheets of paper, handwritten, and I think there were about 15 different points that he wanted to cover, having to do with Jung's authority and what people are supposed to believe is the authentic Jungian thinking. If Jung says this in Answer to Job, then doesn't that require everybody who calls himself a Jungian to say the same thing? And how can a Catholic say this about God? And the stars were really against them. Even if Jung had been willing to meet with White and talk about this in detail, this was the summer that Emma Jung was dying. She'd been diagnosed with cancer. She'd had a surgery. It was not really operable. She was sent home with a few weeks or months to live. Jung and Emma, CG and Emma were, and their family were going through a very, very hard summer. She died finally in November. But this was the summer when Jung was dealing with the aftermath of her surgery. She wasn't even out yet from the convalescent home. White went to the convalescent home to talk with Jung about Answer to Job and brought with him this long list of particulars. And we don't know precisely what was said, but there is a letter from 1955. And once it was pointed out to me that they had just met, because the letter doesn't say so, but they had just met at this convalescent home in Mamern. Then you can see in the first paragraph what must have happened in that meeting. White wrote, "On the 21st of May, My dear C.G., I'm afraid it was disgracefully inconsiderate of me to trouble you with my very mundane problems, in quotations, when you yourself have so many other cares within and without. I earnestly hope that Mrs. Jung is now well on the mend. Her illness alone must have given you great anxiety, and of course I realize that you have many other cares on your mind. It was heartless of me to bother you with such very different problems, and so ruthlessly. Evidently, I must work them out on my own as best I can, and perhaps in our mutual solitude, the reconciling symbol has a better chance to grow than in any amount of talk. Now, in our mutual solitude, I read that to mean we are not in communication, you and I, anymore. My guess is that Jung said, enough. Enough. I'm sorry. That's all. I can't anymore. Whether he had seen White's review of Answer to Job or not, there was something in this rage. White had reason to be in a rage. It's just that Jung wasn't the enemy. And so the tragedy for White is that he lost his job, he lost his community, he lost his friend. Just wiped out. So he went back to England, White did, and he lived in Cambridge at the Cambridge House, and he did his research and his study and his writing, and he produced one more book before he died, Soul and Psyche, which was published just before White's death. The grace in it, the grace in the story, was that final intervention, that intervention from Sister Michael, who was able to help Jung overcome his, I think rancor might not be too strong a word, and forgive his friend because his friend was dying. And at the end of their lives, there were about eight letters exchanged between 59 and 60. White had this motorcycle accident. Then he was healing up from that, and there was something wrong in his stomach, and they did an operation and found he had inoperable cancer. It was either stomach or intestinal. White referred to it as a growth down there, and he couldn't eat at the end of his life. White was taken in by a community of, an intentional community of analyzed people in London. And after his death, Jung got a very full description of White's last days from Mrs. C.K. Ginsburg, and there's a letter of Jung's to her in the published letters, describing his final moments. Jung also received a description of White's final moments from Sister Michael, because although Sister Michael couldn't leave her cloister, she'd been very much in touch with White. They were sending each other letters and postcards. And a mutual friend had come to her after White's death and given her a full description of White's last moments. But until that point, up to his death, Jung and White exchanged letters that are really very touching in their acknowledgement that they still don't understand each other, that they haven't got the problems worked out. They started to try to work the old stuff again, and White was too ill. He couldn't connect with it anymore. And Jung quickly let it go and apologized, and just sent a loving letter to him expressing his wish that White should know that Jung was still his friend. Let's see. This is the one that he wrote, Jung wrote, when he gave up trying to talk about the substantial issues. My dear Victor, I have heard of your illness, and I should have liked to come to England to see you, but I have to be careful with my own health, and I must avoid all exertions. As I am completing my 85 years, I am really old, and my forces are definitely limited. In February, I had a bit of a heart embolism, and my doctor is strict. I have to thank you for the kind gift of your book, Soul and Psyche. It is certainly a theme worthy of a lengthy discussion in the Auseinandersetzung between theology and psychology, the Auseinandersetzung, the wrestling, the coming to terms. I have just begun to read it. I had to finish the book Psychotherapie und Religion by Dr. Joseph Rudin, S.J., the Psychotherapy and Religion. The bit I have read in your book is most interesting and promising, and I shall certainly go on studying it carefully. In the meantime, I hope you don't worry about my letter. I want to assure you of my loyal friendship. I shall not forget all the useful things I've learned through our many talks and through your forbearance with me. I was often sorry to be a Petra Scandali, a stumbling block, or literally a rock of scandal. It is my fate, however, not my choice, and I had to fulfill this unbecoming role. Things had to be moved in the great crisis of our time. New wine needs new skins. We need no further outbursts on a grand scale, or so it seems to me. The Iron Curtain is quite sufficient to me to demonstrate the enormous split in the soul or psyche of modern man, but we are mostly asleep. It needs some noise to wake the sleepers. Many greetings and cordial wishes. Yours ever, C.G. And with this letter, I think this is the one, yeah, enclosed in this letter was a recent black and white photograph, a snapshot of Jung in the doorway at Küsnacht, dressed in a sporty suit. And on the back he had written, "Instead of myself in persona, I come at least in effigie, in figure." Poor Victor. He had written a letter to Jung to try to explain himself once again about Answer to Job. And he followed that with, "My very dear C.G., I composed and dictated the enclosed incoherent letter before your wonderful and comforting letter dated April 30th arrived. I'm sending it to you all the same. Of course, I will understand that it is impractical for us to meet at present. Perhaps we'll meet in another world or dimension where we know even as we are known. I'm glad to hear that you have a copy of my book, even though I'm afraid you may not like it at all. It should in any case be different from that of Father Rudin. You will realize, I'm sure, that I have to think and talk in an environment, not only theological, very different from that of the Zurich Institute, and I'm more convinced than ever of the importance of your pioneer work for humanity, even for those who cannot agree with every word you say, but have to take part in the dialectic discussion with you. But I am now finding that it is one thing to write a book, especially that part on life and death, and that it is quite another to live it and have to keep those opposites here constantly in mind and together. If ever you should have time or inclination to send me any comments on anything in my book, of course, I should be delighted and profited. I do not know if it is true that you have been a Petra Scandali to me, as you say you have, but to the extent that you may have been, I think I can honestly say that I'm grateful for it. May I add that I pray with all my heart for your well-being, whatever that may be in the eyes of God. Yours ever cordially and affectionately, Victor White." White had been in the habit of drawing jaunty little marks under his name. For a long time, he was drawing a slash diagonally and two little dots, which I think stood for OP, Order of Preachers. And then later, he dropped that, and he began doing a squiggle, long extended S shape. And then, in this last letter, he just drew a single line, like the end, the bottom of the row of numbers, add it all up, finis. But there's a joke in this letter. In the text of it, he was having help from people who typed for him. He would dictate, and somebody would write it down and then type it up. He had two versions of this last letter. One was the rough copy and one was the final copy. And in the final copy, the typist had written Petrus Scandali instead of Petra, which White allowed to stay. He corrected a bunch of things in the letter, but he left Petrus. Well, it's only a joke in the sense that Petrus is the Latin for Peter. Instead of a rock of stumbling, it's the Peter of stumbling. And there had always been a little something in Jung's view, in White's view of Jung, that confused him slightly with an archbishop or a pope. He saw him as the head of his own order, as it were. And you've been to me a Peter of scandal. Now, I'm aware of time. Are you tired of sitting? Would you like to take a break? We'll have some time at the end, but let's see. There's a picture I'd like to show you of White as an older man. Since we've been talking about all the biography. Is it clear? I'm sorry? Now that's very nice. Yeah, I think so. I think he looks like someone who has a bitter taste in his mouth. But he had a steady gaze. I think he had courage. Jung wrote to someone at the end, I think it was Mrs. Ginsberg, who offered to send him deathbed drawings. When White died, someone came in and drew his head, and someone also painted a picture of him after death. And Mrs. Ginsberg volunteered to send him those copies of those, and he said, "No, I want to remember the man gazing steadfastly forward. I want to remember him as he was in life." I don't know the year that was taken. It was given to me by the archivist in Edinburgh, the Dominican, the old man who's the Dominican archivist, without any date attached. But it was a professional portrait. I think it's later than the one taken at Bollingen anyway. I had written a good deal of stuff about the theoretical differences between them, but I don't want to cheat you of something that's probably more interesting. And you can read my book if you really want to know. I promised something about the missing fourth. So I'm going to take this is a sub-lecture. This is the other lecture. It doesn't exactly fit in, but it's relevant because I promised it. The missing fourth in Jung's writings. You know, Jung refers to the three and the four, this alchemical numerical problems, numerology thing that comes up in the with reference to Maria Prophetessa, and gosh, I don't know how many different ways he refers to the three and the four. It's a real theme of his. It's sort of preys on his mind almost. It comes back a lot. Well, I checked out, this is not a deep lecture, this is a shallow lecture, dipping in just a toe into the literature, into Jung's own writings about the three and the four. He so often refers, I'm trying to get that thing where it's not blocking anybody's face. That's why I have to stand right here. Okay. He so often refers to the Timaeus, the Plato dialogue where Socrates is talking with some friends about God and creation and the numerical relationships inherent in goodness and beauty. That's one of the references to the three and the four and the missing fourth. And the other one is from Goethe's Faust, the second half, the second play, where there's one particular scene with one particular little set of Greek gods that can occur in numbers of four or can occur in numbers of eight, but there always seems to be one missing. In Plato's narrative, that narrative, I finally looked it up, it begins, one, two, three, Socrates says, my dear Timaeus, where is the fourth of those who were yesterday my guests and to be my entertainers today? Turns out that the fourth guy who had dinner with Socrates yesterday couldn't come because he was taken ill. So, this is important. You know, we had to have this at the beginning of this deep dialogue. Well, later on we find out something about the importance of four for Plato. God placed air and water in the mean between fire and earth and made them to have the same proportion so far as possible. For Plato, okay. As fire is to air, so air is to water, and water is to earth, Socrates explains. And out of such elements, which are in number four, the body of the world was created, and it was harmonized by proportion, and therefore has the spirit of friendship. So for Plato, the world is unique. He actually calls it monogenes, the same word used for only begotten. It's perfect, and it's beautiful. It's not subject to old age or disease. It is the image of the whole, he says, of which all other animals are portions. Jung comments on this, that Plato's personal situation at the time when the work was written was not all that perfect. He was a disappointed man. The politics of is it Athens? Yes, Athens. His city's political life was not going the way he wanted it to, and his advice was not being taken. And after explaining how Plato was not particularly happy at this moment, Jung says, in this situation, the introductory words of one, two, three, but where is the fourth, which owe their form neither to a humorous mood of the writer nor to mere chance, take on a melancholy meaning. One of the four is missing because of illness. That means, Jung says, if we treat this narrative frame symbolically, that one of the four elements making up physical reality is missing. Either air or water. Don't ask me how he knows that it's either air or water. He just knows. Somebody else can do the research to find out how Jung knew that. If the former, the bridge to the spirit is missing. The bridge to the spirit, well, the spirit is fire. And the bridge to the spirit is air. So either the bridge to the spirit is lacking, or if the latter, the bridge to materiality and concrete reality, earth. If water is missing, then that connecting line to the earth is missing in Plato's schema. Plato has no lack of spirit, Jung says. What he lacks and yearns for is the concrete realization of ideas. He must content himself with a harmonious thought picture without weight and a paper surface without depth. And Jung goes on, in Plato's thought, the step from three to four runs into heaviness, resistance, and limitation that are strange and unexpected and cannot be conjured away or minimized by meon, which is a Greek phrase that Jung uses quite heavily in his letters with Victor White. Cannot be minimized by meon, which Jung understands as meaning non-being, nor by privatio boni. Well, that's the Catholic Church talking. So here, Plato isn't really the audience. Plato is not who Jung is talking to. Jung is talking to modern European Christians, to his audience of today. The step from 3 to 4 runs into heaviness, resistance, and limitation that are strange and unexpected and that cannot be conjured away or minimized by this non-being idea, nor by privationi. Evil isn't just a non-entity. It's not a non-being. It's not a privation of good, a reduction, a shrinking down. Jung is writing about the Trinity. That's from his essay on the Trinity. And if you want to look it up, it's in Collected Works 11, paragraph 185. And that was my translation, not Hull's, because I got it out of his German, out of the German version of that essay. The step from 3 to 4 runs into heaviness, resistance, and limitation that are strange and unexpected, not only to Plato, but to us, or to those who like to live in the perfect, beautiful world of the spirit and of ideas, where things are harmonious. So that's part of what the four means for Jung. Okay, it's a hint. And then in the same lecture, the Trinity lecture, Jung describes the fourfoldness of the cross as being God's suffering in his direct collision with the world. Now that's relevant in any discussion you may ever have about Answer to Job. For Jung, Jesus' suffering on the cross supplies what is missing from the image of God in the soul. It supplies what God was missing. God was missing suffering. And we know that God was missing suffering because God had no empathy for one who suffered. He had no empathy for Job. God gave Satan free rein to do whatever Satan wanted to test Job. And that was not a sympathetic thing to do to the poor creature. And it wasn't until Jesus' suffering on the cross that God got it. That God went through what Job had gone through in the person of Jesus. And that's Jung's idea of the answer to Job. Job said, "What's going on here and how can you do this to me?" And God can't really answer that question. The only way God can answer it is by going through what Job went through. Then Job is answered. So the fourfoldness of the cross in the Christian symbolical world that Jung is interested in, that fourfold cross symbolized God's suffering in his direct collision with the world and, incidentally, with the evil in the world. This is what brings wholeness and healing and transformation not only to sinful humanity, which is what the Christian theologian has always said, but also to God. God becomes whole through suffering. God becomes whole through suffering. There might be something for us in this, that we become whole through suffering. That may be why we resist the fourth, or what Jung calls the fourth. That we like to keep things neat, and we would like not to have to suffer, thank you. And in our preference for staying out of the fire or out of the mud, we prefer the 3 to the 4. I think that's what he's suggesting. When he talks about Plato, I think he's talking about himself and most of us. Then we get to Faust, Part 2, Goethe's late great play. Act 2, lines 8070 to 8226. It really is there. The rocky coastal inlets in the Aegean is where this scene takes place. And the Nereids and the Tritons are singing, and the Sirens are singing, and there's all these Greek mythological characters on stage. And the Nereids and the Tritons sing, referring to a batch of little Greek gods that only live in this part of the Aegean. We have brought three with us. The fourth would not come. He said he was the right one who thinks for all the rest. And then later on, they say, actually, there are seven of them. And the sirens say, and where have the three remained? And the Nereids and Tritons answer, you'll have to go to Mount Olympus to ask. There you will find the eighth, of whom no one has thought. Oh, please, is it three and four, or is it seven and eight? It's hard enough figuring out the three and the four. Why is it now suddenly seven and eight? Well, the Kabiri, that's the sort of Latinized version of these little gods. They could be in Greek Kabiroi. Let's just say there's a small group of them. There's either four or eight, I don't know. Little gods of the Aegean, this one special island off of Greece. Individually, they have no names. They're just the Kabiri. They've been honored since primeval times, Goethe tells us. And they're not to be taken lightly. They aren't funny little gods. They're very powerful. They present a severe picture. Goethe says, ein streng Gebilde. They are pictured, mirrored in somebody's shield as they arrive, and they are hailed as a severe image. And it is added, they rescue mariners whose ships go down. Well, okay. Jung then talks about Goethe. Who is this fourth? Who's missing? Let's look at the individual situation of the writer. We did that with Plato, didn't we? Let's do it with Goethe. Well, the fourth who's missing thinks that he's the right one. He thinks he's the one who's got it right. He thinks for all the rest, but he didn't show up. And Jung says, Goethe's inferior function is thinking. He's a great feeling type, and his thinking is no good at all. He hasn't got any thinking function. It just doesn't come when he calls it. And you can tell because he came up with a cockamamie theory about rainbows and light refraction. Goethe actually wrote that he thought that there was such a thing as a white rainbow, no colors. I mean, he really had a theory about light. And Jung says you can tell from his theory of light refraction, this guy is not a thinker. So the fourth is Goethe's inferior thinking function. The fourth could be the inferior function for any of us at any time. My sensation function makes me really stupid. I don't want anyone to see me using it. I have to spend all day if I'm going to cook something. Now, I love it if I have time, but don't watch and don't ask me to talk to you. I can't do two things at once. I'm cooking. If you think about the eighth that's missing and the fourth that's missing, and you remember that there are four functions, but if you add in extroversion and introversion, there are eight. So isn't that neat that Goethe knew that? Or that it's just archetypally part of the universe that we live in. Or that Jung knew what Goethe wrote, and no, I won't go there. He didn't take it from Goethe. Anyway, Jung connects the 3-4 riddle in Goethe's scene and the Timaeus to the writer's personal psychologies. And he writes, and this is in Collected Works 6, where he's talking about typologies. The limitations of our views and our knowledge are nowhere more apparent than in psychological discussions, where it is almost impossible for us to project any other picture than the one whose main outlines are already laid down in our own psyche. I think that has broader application than just to the issue of 3 and 4. But it gives Jung his excuse for rendering a meaning, for pulling a meaning out of these obscure texts by going to the personal story of the writer and saying, if it's obscure but it's important, let's see what his personal situation was and see if we can make sense of it that way. Now, there's some very interesting stuff written in Jung's work, and then I've got something also from von Franz. And I'll stop in 5 minutes about integrating the fourth, which is what Jung really hopes we can do. It's the hallmark of wholeness is to integrate the fourth. And if we are talking about the fourth strictly in terms of the inferior function, we'll have enough work to do. The inferior function, Jung says, behaves like many repressed or insufficiently appreciated contents, which are partly conscious and partly unconscious. Thus, in normal cases, the inferior function remains conscious, at least it's in its effects. But in a neurosis, it sinks wholly or in part into the unconscious. And I would add to that, not just in neurosis, I think also in the grips of strong emotion or illness or exhaustion. And I say that with Jung's permission, because in his essay, in his lecture that he gave in 1948 on the self, which later became the core of his book Ion, he has a passage which later, when it was translated and put into Ion, this last sentence got dropped. But he says that people are completely unable to master their fourth, or they have no access to it, or it overpowers them. They fall into it when they're in the grips of strong emotion or illness or exhaustion. And that phrase got dropped for some reason. But I can document it if someone wants me to. And then he says also about the fourth function and about integrating it. Thus, it is not to be a detachment or a redemption of the inferior function. You don't cut it off and get rid of it. You can't anyway. And it's not to be redeemed, that is, made into one of the leading functions, maybe. It will always be the inferior function. But an acknowledgement of it, a coming to terms with it, that unites the opposites on the path of nature. And that's again in Collected Work 6 on typology. Coming to terms with the fourth function, Jung says, and later von Franz reiterates, means bringing down your higher functions. It brings your overall functioning down to somewhere in the middle. It's hard to do. It's hard to give up what you're good at and practice doing something that you're lousy at. It's bad for your income, for one thing. It's hard in all sorts of ways. You're not a one-sided person any longer, just specializing in what you're really good at. And that's great. Not to be one-sided is very desirable. But you're also not a super achiever. You're somewhere in the middle. And von Franz makes this very graphic. She has in her essay on the inferior function, she has a sketch of conscious and unconscious, and somebody who's got their fourth function more or less available to consciousness, and they brought everything down to somewhere in the middle in this graph. In that essay, The Inferior Function, which I think was originally probably a lecture, because there are questions and answers at the end, von Franz has an observation about how hard it is to integrate the fourth function and how people may try for a while and then give it up. She says, you have a great many people but then the devil remains in a corner of your life. People who stick in this phase, she says, never quite understand what Jung means by the problem of the fourth, and they never quite understand what individuation really means. They remain in the conventional former world of identifying with consciousness. Many people who've even undergone a Jungian analysis do not get further than those brief visits into the fourth realm, and then talking about it to others, not really staying in it because it is hellishly difficult to achieve. I came across that paragraph when I was reviewing her essay on the inferior function. And what jumped out at me was she was describing Victor White. She was describing somebody she knew. And maybe it wasn't really Victor. It sounds like Victor White to me. He visited the Jungian individuation process enough so he could talk about it. White was a quick study, and everything he read, he wrote about almost immediately. He integrated things intellectually, very fast. But Jung, in the letters between them, Jung is reminding him towards the middle of the time when they're beginning to have trouble. He says to him, Victor, you don't have your feeling function under any kind of control. It's not accessible to you. Look at the dream you've just sent me. The feeling function is getting in your way. And White says, you're right. And in this dream, I don't seem to be able to relate to the hard realities of the rock in the quarry. It's a make-believe quarry. It only looks like rock. It's not real. And I can't get the unconscious to be real in my thinking. And Jung says, yep, that's it. That's it. There's something in White's psychology, and I say this loving him and respecting him, that doesn't fully grasp or hasn't been grasped by what Jung means by individuation. White had a great deal invested in being an Orthodox Catholic theologian, and he couldn't bear Jung's answer to Job, partly because it flips all the values on their heads, and that Trinitarian thought that Jung says is characteristic of Catholic theologians generally, White couldn't really give it up. So incorporating the fourth into the Trinity, or incorporating suffering into God, or saying that God had been unloving to Job, it was very hard for him to do it. He couldn't stomach it. What's remarkable and probably salvific in this story is that they really did love each other. Even in the worst period, in 1955, when White had already written the letter to Jung that said, I don't know if you can forgive me for the review I've written, and they were having such a hard time with Answer to Job. And Emma Jung had been diagnosed with cancer. And there were a lot of reasons Jung might have wanted to distance himself before he did. He invited White to stay with him. He invited White to be a guest of the family. He invited him to Küsnacht, not to Bollingen. And that's been interpreted as a sign of how estranged they were. But I don't think that he could have invited him to Bollingen. Jung had to look after Emma. He did take Emma to Bollingen for a little while that summer, but he brought her right back to Küsnacht. Jung couldn't go off to Bollingen and go sailing with White. He was looking after a sick wife. But he invited White to stay at the house. And it wasn't until White came to him in Mamern at the convalescent home with his long list of protests against Answer to Job that Jung said, we can't anymore. I think that if they hadn't really loved each other as friends, the mediating bridge offered by Sister Michael at the end of White's life wouldn't have held. They couldn't have connected. They couldn't have redeemed that relationship. But in fact, there was a very important relationship there worth redeeming. When it broke, the container of all that sacred meaning broke, and there was a great need for somebody to provide a new container to hold it all. And I think that was her function, the Mother Prioress at the end. Jung's break with White has been compared with his break with Freud. But the two stories end very, very differently. When Freud and Jung broke, I think it was Jung who wrote The Rest is Silence. And it was. That was that. They never communicated with each other as friends again. I think they communicated through intermediaries at a certain point in the Second World War when Jung was trying to help Jews get out of Vienna. But when Jung died, he left the letters that he had exchanged with Victor Wright. He had all of Wright's letters, or almost all of them, and he had copies of almost all of his. And he left them with his son to be carefully shepherded until they could be published someday. And they had to be carefully shepherded because the end of their relationship had been so problematic and so tough. Jung was afraid that they would be published by someone who would demean one or the other of them. So they had to be brought to life, but safely. And I think that means respecting them both and not denying or minimizing their struggles and not blaming them for being human. Given the challenge of their task, which was interdisciplinary and enormous and carried on at geographic and cultural distance and with outer circumstances like Wright's being fired from his job that were not friendly, I think it's no scandal to admit that at times both of them failed to embody the force of ideal wholeness. Images of the self, as they do when Jung is working on the self, his lecture on the self. It sneaks into the language. It sneaks into imagery. The letters are very, they're just riddled with it. Once I started looking for it, I realized that it had been there all along. I think the self was looking for an incarnation. And it needed some people. And it you know, chose these two. And the price they paid for it was considerable. You know, considerable suffering. And the fact that it was worth doing was something they were both attesting to at the end in their different language. I'm sorry, I lost my sense of the limits of time on this. Repeat the question before answering it. I'm going to try, and you tell me if I've got the essence of what you just asked me. What is it that brings people together? What was it that brought Jung and Wright together? I said that the self had an agenda or something to achieve here and invited them in, or you know, urged them, or somehow constellated itself through them. But what, in the personal sense, not giving the self credit for all of it, but what in the personal sense, I'm guessing, I'm interpreting, can make people ripe for that kind of connection to each other? Where there's, you mean the kind of connection where there's so much spiritual or intellectual freight, or what kind? I can think of lots of things that bring people together, but this was a particular kind of collaboration, a particular friendship.
Right. I guess I'm thinking of the kind of the relationship that is the constellation itself. You know, what is it that they were seeing each other or attending to each other, whether it be the missing force that was trying to, you know, manifest, or mm-hmm. what is it that we're attending to when we're sort of walking into this invitation? What are we
attending to in a conscious way? Uh-huh. What's our conscious intention when we're walking into this? Or unconscious. But anyway, what makes us apt to do it?
I mean, you're saying there's some type of affection and friendship, and is it a type of desire and love, and what is it, a desire and a love?
One One possible answer to that, and I don't know if I'm the only person in the room who might have an answer to that. Just one splinter of an answer would have to do with similar complexes. And I mean that in the sense that both Jung and White were preacher's sons. They've both been pastor's kids. White's father was an English, an Anglican priest. And White converted to Roman Catholicism. Jung's father, we know, was a pastor, Reformed Swiss pastor, and Jung rejected much that his father's faith contained. So each of them had been, in a way, in rebellion against his father's religious orientation, and the fathers had both been pastors. And I'm guessing that there's a God problem as well as a father problem in that for both of them that might have made them ripe for this kind of work. That's a reductive answer in a way.
Did they both have a kind of rebelliousness?
That they both had a rebellion, that they both rebelled against their father's religious world. And in some way, they were still suffering the wound of that. That they'd gotten separated from, that what they had rejected still called to them in some form, wanting to be reconnected with their fathers, perhaps, but also wanting to be reconnected with God, if not in their father's form, then in some other form, and having rejected their father's form, they had to find another one. It's only a quick answer, and I'm afraid partly a reductive one, because I'm reducing it down to wounds from childhood. But why shouldn't the self make use of our wounds from childhood? Yes? Well, the statement was made, the friendships that Jung had only lasted as long as you agreed with him, and when you disagreed, you were out the door. And I don't know the particulars of the Tony Wolfe story that you're talking about. I know that in 1946, Tony Wolfe was still very much part of Jung's circle. She might not have been as intimately involved with Jung as she had been when they were younger, but she was certainly still persona grata and teaching at the... She taught at the club until the day she died and was still... But maybe you mean there's an inner circle of Jung's and Tony Wolfe's. Well,
they're pretty close, far along.
Yes. And he went on praising her in public through the time the Institute was founded and beyond. And he wrote a foreword to her book when it came out after her death. So he still valued her as a colleague for whatever else might have happened. But as far as White goes, I'm struck in these letters by how patient Jung is for so long, because White began disagreeing with him and even criticizing him in print back in 1949. And they didn't really have their break until Emma Jung was dying and White was really out of his mind with anger. He wrote things that he couldn't even stand up for later. And in fact, I think White was dissociative when he wrote those things. Later in his dying year, he was still able to think clearly about some things, and he knew enough to take those passages out. But when Jung said to him in a letter, "You had expressed yourself publicly in such a way that I didn't know what your true feelings were," and White wrote back and said, "What is this I'm supposed to have said? Could you be talking about my review of Volume 7? I thought I was very..." He forgot. I think there was something dissociative about that review, and I think White's whole demeanor and attitude and emotional state that summer, spring and summer of 55, was beyond what Jung could cope with then. It wasn't that White had disagreed with him. It was the state White was in and the demand he was making on Jung at that point when Jung couldn't do it anymore. I think Jung stayed with White expressed caring for him, made jokes with him, invited him to come see him, even after White had published something quite critical about Jung's Über das Selbst, on the self. White read that Ehrenhaus lecture and wrote some things about Jung being a pseudo-Manichaean or a crypto-Manichaean, a quasi-Manichaean. And, and if Jung would just read certain things that Thomas Aquinas had written, Jung would understand much better. And it was, it was a somewhat condescending, critical review. And Jung was stung. And Jung got back at him by writing to him a long letter full of Greek, and White couldn't read Greek. And but this isn't the same as rejecting him as a friend. You know, they started to fight about things, but they didn't quit being friends until something really, really egregious happened. And then it was White's doing more than Jung's. Yeah. I'm sorry, I'm looking at both of you at once. Why don't you go first and then John?
I was just thinking of the tension on the opposite side. And do you see something there that you could comment on?
You're seeing the tension of the opposites, and is there something I can comment on? Say more, please.
Well, these two are opposite sides of the clear, and they're not holding the tension.
That they didn't hold the tension of the opposites.
Yeah, I'm just thinking
that. Well, at a certain point in the relationship, the container of the friendship broke. For emotional reasons, not for intellectual ones. When the container broke, there was no way to hold the tension of the intellectual opposition. As long as they had the affectional connection between them, the friendship was a container for all the fighting they might need to do. And when White betrayed the friendship, at least in a couple of ways, that the personal things he said about Jung in his review of Answer to Job really were a betrayal of friendship. It went beyond criticism.
Right, so because of that emotional break, they couldn't come up with the middle path.
Because of the emotional break, my way of phrasing it would, you're putting it in terms of the middle path. Mm-hmm. And that may be very true and very useful. My way of phrasing it would be that the container for the tension had broken. The vessel broke. The alchemical vessel broke at that point. And all the contents, including all the tension of opposites and the marriage of opposites, everything was, you couldn't go on with it anymore. Yeah. John?
I was just reflecting on motivation for that. And whether, it seems as if the political, and you said the falling out was caused by the unfortunate political system, and perhaps he was still playing to that political situation when he wrote the review. He had a motivation that may not have been completely himself in that. He might have already been distracted by his other realm.
You're asking if White's motivation in writing the review of Answer to Job might have been politically, it might have been affected by the politics of his situation, and that he might have been distracted by the politics and not really paying full attention to what he was writing. And I think the answer to that is there was no way he could get his job back. He could not get the job back. It had been canceled. His work had, no. That was gone.
You said it came time for him to do that. Under what circumstances?
The question is, it came time for him to write the review. What forced him to write it at all? White had a self-concept to maintain. Up until now, he had been probably one of the leading English Jungians, English people, intellectuals, responding to Jung's published work in print with reviews, year after year after year. It's part of his job now. people are looking to him to say something. And he, his review of Answer to Job was an interesting mixture. In some ways, it was a responsible, intellectual, theological consideration of the book of Job and of Jung's book. And then it suddenly would break out into these unspeakable attacks. And then he would go back to being measured and reasonable and responsible. And then there'd be another of these zingers. And later he took out the zingers, and the rest of the text is really pretty okay. Yeah. Yes. Okay, let's see if I've got what you asked. You said Meister Eckhart had founded the Dominicans. I don't think that he founded them. He was an early prominent Dominican. Yeah. Medieval figure. A prominent one. But I'd say Aquinas was a much more important figure for Victor White, for his teaching, although certainly he knew Eckhart's work. And you said, help me. It was important. Oh, it was about Victor White being the object of jealousy because he was so much part of Jung's inner circle. He was welcomed in a way so many people wanted to be and weren't. And you may have read something about it in Deirdre Baer's book because I think she commented that Jung had been positively rude to people who came to the gate at Bullingen and wanted to come and see him, and Victor White was visiting. I think Jung had a habit of being fairly short-tempered with people that came uninvited to Bullingen, period. It wasn't just about whether White was there, but she may have had reasons for saying that. And she may have been quoting people who lived through those years. But what was the connection that you were making between that and Morton Kelsey, that's where you went with it. Yes. Morton Kelsey's not Catholic. He's Anglican, right? That's different. You can teach at Notre Dame as an Anglican, and you're still not under the threat that a Catholic would be teaching at Notre Dame. Because the Pope can't do anything to you if you're an Anglican. He can't refuse to have your books taught in other places, for instance. You can't be put on the list, on the index. Well, you can't. Oh, yes, there are liturgical parallels, there's historical parallels. The Catholics and the Anglicans have many common roots. That is absolutely true. And when it comes to understanding of Jung's Answer to Job, acceptance of it, I mentioned one of Victor White's colleagues and friends at Blackfriars named Richard Kehoe. One of the last things Richard Kehoe did before leaving the Dominican order, and he left for personal reasons not related to this whole battle, was to write a very understanding and accepting review of Answer to Job. where he said that Jung's position in this book might be hard for some Catholics to accept or to read, that it's sometimes very raw. But if you think about Job's outcry against God and you see how much Jung is identifying with the suffering, then you see that Jung is speaking in Job's voice. And it's an amplification of Job's complaint against God. He's just, it's consistent. It's all in a line. It's all of a piece with what Job said. And that's published in the Bible. I don't think I'm doing an adequate job of summing up what Richard Kehoe wrote, but it was along those lines. And he could accept it, and he was a faithful Catholic, and it was okay. Something else was going on with White about it, I think. I don't think White was reading it symbolically. I think he had flattened it out to become concrete and literal. And at a literal level, he couldn't coordinate it with the primary things that Catholics have to be able to say about God and still be Catholic.
Jung was saying he was horrified when he heard that some people thought he was talking about God instead of
the God image. Yes. Jung was horrified that some people didn't realize he was talking about the image of God.
Right.
And I just want to say about that Jung says a tremendous amount in his later work about God or the image of God. He isn't always careful in saying imago Dei or the image of God. And that since for Jung there is nothing that can be known about God separate from the psyche, it's all this Kantian, neo-Kantian, filtering through our own categories of perception and understanding. And that's the only way we know anything. So we don't have access to God as God is in God's self. And Jung and Thomas Aquinas would agree on that point. That's any thinking person has to come up with that eventually. But the thing is that Jung writes so much about God, and there is only this way of knowing God. And if there is only this way of knowing God, then for the writers of Scripture, there is also only this way of knowing God. And eventually, what's the difference between what Jung is saying and what a theologian says? We're all working out of the same human filter of experience. And so if a theologian's going to talk about God, why can't Jung also talk about God? We're all talking about the God image, or God as we know what we know. So eventually, I think Jung has to be answerable in some way for doing maybe not very well-trained theology, but he's doing some. Yeah. Excuse me, John?
Yeah, well, I was really taken by your description of looking forward to the suffering of God and God. And another thing that our group is looking at is the public psyche. And I'm wondering, the incredible popularity of Gibson's film, couldn't be interpreted as some expression of attraction to this force.
The comment is that with the thoughts that Jung had about the missing fourth and the cross, the fourfold cross as being an expression of God's suffering, in the public psyche, maybe a film like Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ is trying to get at something about the integration of the missing fourth, putting the suffering of God out there for us to contemplate, where we can't turn away from it. It's very graphic. And I haven't got an answer, but I think it's just an interesting thought. Anything that addresses the suffering of God in a context that make people take it seriously and feel it deeply could be congenial with what Jung is saying about integrating the missing fourth. Certainly could be. Thank you.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.